Hello and welcome to this podcast on behalf of the British Society for Heart Failure. I'm Andrew Clark. I'm a cardiologist in Hull, working at the Hull York Medical School, and I'm the past chair of the British Society for Heart Failure and a member currently of the research committee at the BSH. I'm delighted to be able to welcome Tony Richards, who's Professor of Surgery, joining us from Perth in Australia. And it's a joy that he's here. He's signalling T for time out. I can't hear you. You're on mute.
Toby, not Tony.
I said Tony? Oh, God.
It's my dad's name, and I'm starting to look like him.
I'm so sorry. A colleague of mine who's a respiratory physician called Tony has just died, so I've got Tony on my mind. Apologies, that was terrible. If I do that again, just kick me metaphorically. I'm just going to carry on from where we were. I'm delighted to welcome Toby Richards, who's Professor of Surgery, and he's joining us from Perth in Australia, where it's quite a different time, but very much similar outside as it is here, because we've chosen to record on a beautiful day with clear blue skies outside. Toby's been involved in anemia management and intravenous iron therapy for about 30 years or so. And his underlying belief, underlying why he's using intravenous iron, is that it's very important to try to optimize a patient's health and fitness before any surgical procedure, as that's highly likely to improve their prognosis and make their recovery following surgery very much more enthusiastic. He's been involved in a whole series of trials of intravenous iron, ranging from female athletes to perioperative patients and intensive care patients. So, Toby, if I could start by asking you briefly to give us some background to your involvement with iron, particularly iron in surgery, and then we'll move on to thinking about heart failure, because to start off with, it's going to seem a bit odd for a BSH audience to be listening to a professor of surgery talking about perioperative management.
Thank you. And it's absolutely delightful to be here, because in the world of iron deficiency, some of the best data in the patient populations come from the heart failure patients. Where does this all go back to? Well, when I was a junior doctor in the last century, my registrar happened to be this guy called Ian McDougall. And he was working at the Royal London Hospital looking at renal failure patients. And that was the time when the Venofer product had just come out, which meant moving from high molecular weight dextran products, which were associated with anaphylaxis, to the newer generation of products, which were sugar-based carbohydrates. And Venofer was the very first one off the block in that field.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because I too trained last century, as you can tell by the shock of grey hair. And I absolutely vividly remember being taught how incredibly dangerous intravenous iron was and how you must never use it. And actually, for physicians of my generation, that's been quite a thing to get my mind around.
Oh, and it's still common perception today. It really is. Particularly in the UK and Europe, the people, when you talk about intravenous iron, they raise the word anaphylaxis straight away. I'm currently working in Australia, where we've got one of the highest per capita uses of intravenous iron. In fact, about 2% of the entire population of Australia has had intravenous iron.
Good Lord.
It's available on the PBS, which means that it's funded, and it's routinely given in GP practices on a daily basis. It's not a hospital-based product, and people don't understand why today, with the modern iron preparations, why there's a concern. It's the normal here.
Good heavens. But
anyway, I'm digressing already. But yes, so I started off working in renal transplantation, and the use of intravenous iron was vital there, because the one thing you don't want to do to a transplant patient is give them another transplant, i.e. a blood transfusion.
Yeah.
Because the more blood transfusions you give to a transplant patient, the more antibodies they develop, and therefore the harder it is to cross-match them in the future. And that sort of has been something that stuck with me over the last sort of 25 years of how do you best prepare someone for surgery? And several years later, I did my PhD at in Birmingham on the liver transplant unit. And I was looking at the hypoxic gene induction process during that time frame. And that's when HIF-1 alpha had just been discovered and the proline hydroxylase inhibitors. So my PhD was on HIF-1 alpha. And in that crazy small world that it turns out to be, I then moved to kidney pancreas transplantation at the time of non-heartbeating retrieval. And for that group of patients, you're putting the transplants in and the kidneys take 4 to 6 weeks to kick in and start working. And this sort of common sense came in of, guys, we've got to stop bleeding these people twice a day, because guess what? We're making them anemic. And then we're giving them blood transfusions. So the question is, what blood are you actually measuring when you've actually transfused someone and then you're taking a blood test? It's like, what are you actually measuring here? And it just sort of dawned on me. I was like, maybe we can do this a little bit better and actually crank up the EPO and crank up the iron levels artificially, preparing these people for surgery, and therefore reduce unnecessary interventions into surgical patients and improve outcomes. And that's really been the background behind it all.
All right. And it's always struck me that the way that iron infusion has come into being thought about in heart failure has been off this background of renal medicine. And I do just wonder if, in fact, the situation of the anemia of people who have kidney diseases may well be very different from the anemia of people with heart failure, or at least the iron deficiency of people with heart failure. And one of the key differences in the way that we manage it in patients with heart failure as opposed to patients with renal disease is that you use EPO in renal disease. And is it not true to say that a lot of the iron story started when there was the observation that giving EPO on its own for renal transplant patients or for renal patients really didn't do the trick, because they were immediately becoming iron deficient and you have to give the EPO and the iron together?
No, absolutely. The Ian study that we were doing, the key that it showed was if you fill up people's iron stores, you use less EPO. And so at that time, EPO was quite expensive. And so that was seen to be a good thing, concept of do the right thing, prevent a future intervention. The other side was around about 15 years ago, there were 4 major randomized controlled trials on erythropoietin. And in some countries, they were driving the hemoglobin levels really quite high, above 120. And in that group of people where you artificially drove high hemoglobin levels, there was a higher instance of venous thromboembolism. And so these 4 trials came out in high-level journals, all in the space of about 18 months, and literally overnight, EPO was seen to be the devil's drug, and it had to be stopped. And so that was, I think, about 15 years ago, that was a big surge in venifer, and then it would have been infed at that time coming in. And then more recently, you know, for the modern generation, 2008, 2009, are the new iron carboxymaltose, iron isomaltoside, or the new name for it, came in, which are these new products, which are complex carbohydrates bound to iron, and they enable you to give a big treatment dose, 1,000 milligrams, maybe even, I mean, sometimes we're giving up to 2,000 milligrams in a go. But safely, really safely.
And quickly,
the same side effect profile of an intravenous antibiotic.
Yeah.
In 15 to 30 minutes. And so I think they've been an absolute game changer in that regard.
And clearly in Australia, they've taken off in an enormous way. So I mean, 2% of the population is absolutely staggering. So this is this in relation to perioperative management chiefly, or has this just become sort of standard therapy for people who need a pick-me-up, or just anybody who looks like they may be anemic or iron deficient?
No, I think that's a really good point. I mean, I think like many things, it has to be driven by data. And the data was, you know, 10 years ago, we were suddenly waking up to the fact that in surgery, we had a love affair with blood. It was almost seen to be heroic. If you were a surgeon, had wet boots, you know, that was a macho sign of a great operation. And suddenly we started questioning that and saying, well, you know, maybe not having a couple of units of blood every single time you have an operation is a good thing. Maybe we should look to not giving lots of blood transfusions. And what's an alternative? And so we looked at many factors, but one of them was, if you give intravenous iron prior to surgery, do you increase the hemoglobin and therefore reduce the need for transfusion? At the same time this came out, that was sort of the preoperative optimization. Attention to detail in surgery, and particularly the introduction of keyhole surgery, reduced blood loss in surgery. The use of tranexamic acid should not be underestimated. That's a fantastic drug. It's dirt cheap, minimal side effects, reduces blood loss. And stopping junior doctors taking blood out of patients. That's something we've got to continually address. Their love affair with unnecessary blood tests.
It's those wicked consultants going around saying, what's the hemoglobin every morning? I blame you.
Yeah, there is that. But, you know, do we really need to do liver function tests and serum rhubarbs on a daily basis?
Quite so. If you're seeing somebody whom you're proposing to operate on, how do you assess their need for intravenous iron? Do you actually try and assess that, or do you just say, right, I'm giving you a gram of iron?
Look, I think that's an incredibly good question, and I will defer you to my next publication. look, I think it's a really, really sensible and plausible question. And at the time we looked into this, there was, I've given the background, but there was association that anemia was associated with worse outcomes after surgery. And it didn't really matter what you looked at, whether or not it was having a bit of your bowel out for bowel cancer or cardiac surgery or orthopedic surgery. If you looked at people who were anemic compared to non-anemic people, those people spent longer in hospital, had more complications, and had a worse outcome. And although data were retrospective and associative, there was a clear signal that kept coming out time and time again in multiple databases. And then we reproduced that prospectively in prospective databases. So it looked like anemia was an independent marker. Now, within that, with those data, could we look at different aspects of iron metabolism and iron deficiency? The answer was no. So the question we addressed in a clinical trial called PREVENT was, in people who have anemia before major abdominal surgery, where you're likely to have a blood transfusion, if we give you a big slug of iron compared to those people, we just do a placebo. Do we increase the hemoglobin? Do we make people feel better? And do they do better at operation? And so in that study, we randomized 487 people across the United Kingdom. They were well balanced and they all underwent big operations. They got their iron around about 15 days prior to surgery, between 12 and 22. And that's pretty good going, because most people from the date of booking to operation, it's about 2 weeks in the NHS. So actually it's pretty good going. And if you're gonna get a hemoglobin response, you need at least a week. So the mechanism was there. And we did see that hemoglobin increased, but not as much as we hoped. We were hoping for about 8 grams per liter, and we got 6. But the really interesting thing was, it didn't seem to make any difference at all. The primary endpoint was blood transfusion, i.e. did you get transfused or not? And it was 69 out of 240 in one group and 67 out of 240 in the other group. So the good news from the trialist perspective is there was zero, no difference at all, no trends. The worst scenario would have been, say, 75-57, p equals 0.06. That would have been a complete headache, but it wasn't. It was like there's nothing. But more importantly, we didn't see anything on post-operative complications, length of stay, etc. So actually, although it was a really sensible idea, really plausible, as a one-size-fits-all, should you give iron to everyone? The answer is probably not. However, there's a caveat. After surgery, and these people had big operations, so they had at least half a litre of blood loss. In the first 8 weeks, there was a huge difference in those people that got iron and placebo. If you were anemic, secondary to the blood loss of surgery, and you had a full amount of iron in your bone marrow, your hemoglobin recovered within 8 weeks compared to the group that had placebo, where they were mostly anemic up to 6 months. And there was a big difference in readmission rates for complications. So it seems like the causality of anemia may well have a role to play. So inflammatory mediated anemia, and we can talk about that, of what that is, as opposed to blood loss mediated anemia, which is unquestionably, you know, an absolute amount of iron is lost because it's on the operating on the floor and then the junior doctor's blood tests. That latter group appears to respond in terms of efficacy much better. And on secondary analysis, so hypothesis generating, there may be an effect of improved recovery after surgery, and that needs to be tested again. But I mean, Andrew, you'll have to refresh me, but that seems not dissimilar to the heart failure story. Whereas some of these results from the four initial heart failure studies suggest reduction in readmission rates to hospital. And that seems to be one of the biggest things we're seeing in the heart failure literature.
Yeah, I agree. I've been publishing little bits about anemia and iron deficiency in patients with heart failure for about 20 years or so. And it's taken a while for that then to translate into what seems to be becoming standard clinical practice. Have you personally been involved in the iron in heart failure story?
Sort of have indirectly, anecdotal story. I started designing the PREVENT trial probably about 2006 with a series of pilot studies. And then when the new products came out in 2008-09, that's when I really started going to work. I did a large meta-analysis using the US Veterans Database on anemia. And I did the pilots, and then a couple of years doing pilot studies in preparation for the randomized controlled trial. And I was in Berlin for a trial meeting on something completely unrelated. And that morning I got the email, you know, guess what's coming out in the New England Today, and there was the FAIR HF, and it was one of those rather bizarre moments, because I threw open the curtains in the morning, you know, Life of Brian moment, and there is
the I hope you were slightly better dressed.
There was the Charité Hospital sign, this big neon light saying Charité, and Stefan Anka was the professor of cardiology at the Charité. And I just read over my morning cup of tea, the FAIR HF study. So I sent him an email saying, you're not going to believe it. I'm right outside your hospital and I've got a great idea for a clinical trial. I think yours is really interesting, but ultimately you made people feel better and walk a little bit further on a 6-minute walk test. If you could do that and make people fitter prior to surgery, you could probably save lives. And so Stefan actually replied to me within about 5 seconds, 2 hours later, I'm sitting in a coffee shop in Berlin getting cross-examined by the professor of cardiology about my H index, about my citations, my work.
That sounds like Stefan. The only thing he's interested in is your H index.
And 4 hours later, he had read my entire protocol, redlined it, and that was the start of 10 years of Stefan helping and guiding me through all the clinical trials. He's been absolutely invaluable.
Yeah. One of the big things it's always seemed to me with the iron in heart failure story has been the problem of trying to define what iron deficiency is. And I think in some ways, and I don't blame Stefan for this in any sense, you have to start somewhere, but I think we've slightly handicapped ourselves by just it's back to this comparison between renal failure and heart failure again. We've slightly handicapped ourselves by just taking off the shelf, as it were, the definition of iron deficiency that comes from renal medicine and applying that to cardiology. And I wonder what you thought of that. It just strikes me that we may have put the cart before the horse, as it were, with that one, and we've not really established what we mean by iron deficiency in people with heart failure.
Look, I think it's really difficult. There's been some cracking studies out recently on iron deficiency in healthy people, which are very interesting. There's three studies, and I can't cite them off the top of my head, but one is, and it could be Zimmerman's group, where he's over the last 20 years in Switzerland, he's been feeding his PhD students, because his studies always include fit and healthy female volunteers, which I'm assuming are his PhD students. So he's been feeding them radio-labeled meals, which are rich in iron, looking at absorption. And a meta-analysis of all his studies, which are amazing, shows that you absorb from your diet about 2 milligrams of iron every day until your ferritin drops below 50. And between 50 and around about 25 to 30, you can absorb about 4 milligrams a day. And you can do that just through normal diet. But below 30, you start exponentially increasing the absorption capacity of iron up to about 16 milligrams a day.
Wow.
And really, that shows that iron deficiency, perhaps to the body, is a ferritin less than 50. Less than 30, you kind of need help. So you need to have extra iron in your diet by the means of iron supplementation. That's my reading of it. There's then a second study looking at hematological markers and how they're impacted according to ferritin level. And the inflection point is a ferritin of 25. So when your ferritin drops below 25, your hemoglobin level starts to get affected. And so my interpretation of this is that it's just a function of time till you become anemic. If you have your red cells turn over every 120-ish days, so if you've got zero iron in the bone marrow, when you turn over your red cells, you can't make any new ones, and so you become anemic really quickly. If you've only got sort of 90-ish, 95% of the iron in your bone marrow, it just takes you a very long time to become anemic.
Yeah.
So my reading is that absolute iron deficiency has changed, and it's definitely gone beyond sort of lab values. A ferritin of 12, Hu definition, which is 15. And I think we're looking at somewhere around about 25 before you start becoming anemic, and 50 to your metabolism returns to normal. But has been tested prospectively.
I mean, it's extraordinary to hear that the absorptive capacity for iron goes up really quite so strikingly. So we're then left with a slightly odd observation that I admittedly only one modest study so far in the heart failure arena, at least, that oral iron supplementation didn't really seem to have any impact at all. Why do you think that might be?
Well, I think there's various aspects. Oral iron relies predominantly on these iron salts, the sulfate, the gluconate, the fumarate. And I must say to the physicians out there, it's a bit of a blunderbuss. You know, if it doesn't work, I'll give more. It's a very orthopedic approach. You know,
how dare you accuse a physician of being an orthopod? That's just,
well, I'm just putting it out there. You know, so you give more oral iron salts, you get more belly ache, because right. as soon as you absorb the iron, which the duodenum is pretty good at absorbing things, so it'll suck in the iron, it'll transport it, your hepcidin levels shoot up really pretty quickly in sort of, you know, dozens of minutes, and then you shut down the transport process. So the iron then sits in the duodenum, goes into the small bowel, affects your microbiome, but more importantly, the cells can continually in the duodenum take up the iron. It's just they can't import it into the blood. So the iron can get across the lining with the gut and get into the cell, but can't get out because the export mechanism is controlled by hepcidin. So all that happens is you then develop toxicity, local toxicity within the cell. The cell then dies and sloughs off and gives you bellyache and diarrhea. And that's why. Right. So giving more doesn't work.
Right. So has anyone actually, I find that absolutely intriguing. So has anybody actually biopsied, say, duodenum in people on iron supplementation and found iron loading in the cells of the duodenal mucosa?
Outside of mice, no.
But in mice, do the mice duodenal cells, do they get iron loaded?
Yeah, I mean, that's... Oh gosh, are you going to ask me to quote something on that? I can't.
No. I'll take it from you. You're a professor of surgery.
Well, iron gets into your cells through two pathways. So HCP1, which is the heme pathway, and then divalent metatransporter, which is generic with zinc and various other things. And there aren't really that many control mechanisms on those that I'm aware of, and I'm rapidly getting out of my area of knowledge here.
Okay. Then the ferroportin that allows the iron into the circulation, and it's the ferroportin that gets blocked by the hepcidin.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so the iron can get into the cell, it can't get out, which is exactly the same hypothesis behind inflammatory mediated iron sequestration in the body.
Right.
In that the macrophages, which trundle around the body, can take the iron up, they just can't get it out because the ferroportin's blocked. So particularly from the spleen, which is basically a filter for old crumbly red cells which get broken up, the macrophages gobble up the iron and recirculate it. And so the macrophages can take up the iron, they just can't get it out to any of the cells or the bone marrow or wherever that need it. And that's why you end up with sort of artificially high ferritin levels, and this concept of functional iron deficiency. And that then raises the next question of what is functional iron deficiency?
Yes. Well, I mean, that does play into the heart failure arena a lot, doesn't it? Because, of course, it's taken a long time for it to gain more than just sort of lip service, but the idea of heart failure as a chronic inflammatory disease of some sort is a very interesting one. And we're very lucky in Hull, we have a very large longitudinal database of more or less everybody we've assessed in outpatients over the last 20 years or so. So it's now got about 15,000 patients in. And in all of those, we know what their left ventricular function is, what their hemoglobins are, and for a large proportion of them, what their basic iron measures might be. And one observation I would offer you is that there's a very strong, not quite linear, but curvy linear relationship between ferritin and outcome. So the higher the ferritin, the worse the outcome.
Which but is that a marker or effect? This is the whole thing. It's like the surgery. Anemia, you know, is a marker of badness. You know, you don't want it.
I'm absolutely right. No, I'm certainly don't think it's the ferritin that's causing harm, but it leads into this problem that we've then set ourselves that ferritin has become one of the most important markers for iron deficiency and has become one of the most important determinants of whether or not you are eligible for having an iron infusion. And I rather suspect we've got that completely wrong, and we shouldn't be using ferritin in that way.
Well, I mean, my next question is, what is ferritin? And then how much iron is in the ferritin? How do you measure the iron in the ferritin? Ferritin is just a cage. I liken it to the biscuit tin. Ferritin, biscuit tin. It's just a tin with ferrous stuff in it. You know, and having lots of biscuit tins is different to having lots of iron within the biscuit tin.
Right.
If that makes sense.
No, yeah.
You're measuring the protein, but you're not measuring the iron within the protein.
Right.
And I'm not sure you can actually measure the amount of iron within ferritin. And ferritin, my understanding, can hold about 3,000 atoms of iron.
Yeah.
I don't know how you know that, but unless you do a mass spec on the blood sample. So, it's going back to first principles. What are you measuring when you measure a ferritin in the setting of heart failure?
Yeah. Well, why are we measuring the ferritin? Why don't we just measure iron? Would be my question. And again, I think it's because we've abstracted the definition used in renal medicine and applied it to heart failure. And that may not have been the right thing to do. So we've, again, using this the database that we have in Hull, we've just published a paper in JACC recently on different potential definitions of iron deficiency in heart failure. And what's interesting to me is that if an iron deficiency definition is going to work as a definition in clinical practice, you want people who have the iron deficiency by that definition to be in some way marked for badness. Mm-hmm. So you would expect those who are labeled as iron deficient to have a worse prognosis than patients who are iron replete. So we've applied various different definitions of iron deficiency to this enormous data set of many thousands of patients. And if we apply the ESC definition of iron deficiency, and remember that's just abstracted from renal medicine, it absolutely does not identify a group of patients who are at higher risk. So if we apply that definition that's been commonly used and unfortunately in some ways has been the entry criterion for the clinical trials, there is no difference in prognosis between those who are iron deficient and those who are iron replete by that definition. In contrast, if you divvy patients up by just their absolute level of iron measured on a blood test, that's an extremely potent predictor of an adverse outcome. So people who have low iron do extremely badly in comparison with people who have normal levels of iron. So one of the things I'd really, really like to do is be able to get hold of iron measurements in the patients who have been in the heart failure trials and see if there's a difference in response between those who are iron deficient by what you might call the Hull criteria, I suppose, as opposed to those who are iron replete. And I rather suspect that intravenous iron may have an awful lot to offer for people with heart failure, but it's going to be in people who've got iron deficiency as measured by a low serum iron, not iron deficiency as measured by the ESC criteria.
My question is, so if we go back to the FAIR-HF study,
right,
which was the first key study on this, the key outcome measure there to me was that you made people feel better and their quality of life scores improved. And this was double blind randomization.
We recruited patients for that study. The double blinding is very interesting. Hiding the intravenous Coca-Cola from people is quite tricksy.
It is. We can park that one because I would say that in the PREVENT trial, we followed the FAIR-HF protocol. We swabbed the skin with iodine and the arm was outside of a curtain.
Indeed, yes. I well remember that. And the blind team and the non-blind team.
We did all that. It was hard work, but we actually asked the patients at operation what they thought they'd got. There's no statistical significance of signal. Right. So you know what? I think, well, in our hands, mate, it worked. I think I can be, I can tell you, we put a lot of, and this is key to clinical trials, methods, methods.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more.
And, you know, I was very happy with the randomization. So we'll park that one, but you made people feel better. And, you know, there are things in life we can't change, you know, death and taxes. But, you know, improving people's quality of life, I would say, is a really quite important finding. And that also correlated with the 6-minute walk test as well. And quality of life is a really hard thing to change in a sick population. Because people adjust their lifestyle to how they are. You know, if you take a newborn mum of twins and you go and see them 2 months postpartum, my opinion that they look fresh and healthy might be very different to their theirs. They might say, I feel absolutely fine. And I'm looking and going, no, you're completely wrecked. And so they adjust their lifestyle to their disability. So I'd say in the heart failure studies, the most inspiring thing for me has been the change in quality of life. So in the whole data, maybe you're not, is that the right endpoint to look for in terms of mortality? Or should we be looking at the quality of their life and how they feel?
Yeah, no, I absolutely take your point, but there's certainly some sort of rather odd things that come out of it. I can't remember if it's FAIR HF or CONFIRM HF. The 6-minute walk test was slightly longer in the people who got iron, but it was 11 meters. And yeah, okay, that achieves statistical significance, but I don't think 11 meters matters. And yet, bizarrely, the patients had a quite a marked improvement in New York Heart Association classification score. And it's, I can't see that an 11 meter difference makes you change from MYHA 3 to MYHA 2.
But there was...
And the trials that have looked at it have shown no improvement in peak oxygen consumption with intravenous iron either. Yeah, okay, I grant you there's going to be lots of different reasons why these things are. But it's just that I have an anxiety that we're doing a very human thing, which is we're picking out the stuff that we like the look of and saying, gosh, this is just great. What else have we got that improves people's quality of life? And we're kind of ignoring the things that we don't really like. But I think that's...
I think it's a fascinating one. I do think the quality of life... So the FAIR HF a priori... primary and secondary endpoints are well-defined. And this is, you know, the primary manuscript, you can't mess. You have to say what you're going to do in a clinical trial. So I am going to randomize people. This is the population I'm randomizing. This is the intervention. This is control. These are my outcomes. You cannot change that in a good quality clinical trial. And this is, I think people don't understand this, that in a high-quality randomized controlled trial, your protocol is like a time capsule. It is locked in a safe. You cannot change it. And when you come to finish your trial, you write your statistical analysis plan before you see any data at all. You have to. And that statistical analysis plan is written down, and you have to report the trial according to the consult statement. And the consult statement is 24 points. By the time you've answered those 24 questions, and it might only be 13, but there's an A and B on them. there is no room in your 2,500 words for opinion, which I think is really, really important. You have to say, I'm doing a trial because I thought iron deficiency was a bad thing. And in heart failure, it makes people unwell. Therefore, we tested iron versus placebo, and we said we were going to test for whether or not they're alive and dead, whether or not they feel better, whether or not their heart failure improves, and whether or not the 6-minute walk test improves. And this is how we're going to do it. And you are only allowed to give the answer to those questions. There's no room in a randomized controlled trial for secondary analysis. And I had a look and saw that on Thursdays, if we randomized on Thursdays, people did really well. Or, you know, with a ferritin at 27 compared to 87, they did better. You're not allowed to do that. So I think you have got to take the data for what they are, and quality data are gold dust. And it, to me, in the heart failure population, it is the ferric HF was a game changer.
Right. But then
what you then say about confirm HF and the VO2 max was about assessment of plausible methodology to explain the primary results. And we didn't, it wasn't there, was it?
No.
Yeah, VO2 max didn't change. Bummer.
You've been in Australia for too long.
But you know, there we get to the next question of what is iron doing.
Well, you before know, we get to that, we then I absolutely agree with you about trial methodology. We've then got Affirm HF, which is much the biggest trial I think so far to have reported, with over 1,000 patients, and that was absolutely neutral on the primary endpoint. And that was hospitalizations for heart failure and CV death, I think, if I've remembered that correctly. And the intravenous iron made no difference to the primary endpoint. Now, with all due respect to what you've just said about trial analysis, with which I would absolutely agree, that hasn't stopped an awful lot of speculation around the Affirm HF results. And people have not been content to say, right, that's neutral. Moving on. What did we get wrong? How do we design the next trial? There's been an awful lot of sort of pseudo explanation of why the results might have been neutral. And therefore, actually, we should carry on doing what we're doing.
But you've got a really nice big study about to report throughout the United Kingdom. Is it the Ironman study?
Indeed, yes. I mean, we really are waiting for Ironman. That's a very important trial. The great thing about Ironman, I think, is that it's powered on mortality. There's absolutely no question but that the patients are either alive or dead. We don't really have to worry too much about blinding when you've got that as an endpoint. So I think that's going to be really important. I hope it's true. I'm not absolutely certain, but I hope it's true that there's enough blood in the bank, as it were, that we're going to be able to analyze the data by different definitions of iron deficiency, because I do just worry that we've got that wrong.
I think it is a bit of an unknown. I think it's certainly an issue in the PREVENT trial. In the PREVENT trial, we had two problems. One, the data that drove the question was about anemia and outcome. It wasn't about iron deficiency and outcome, but then the assumptive causality was absolute or functional iron deficiency, i.e. you're iron deficient secondary to the reason why you're having the operation, i.e. a cancer, or it's secondary to the your comorbidities and again disease process for which you're having an operation, i.e. inflammatory mediated. Now the primary endpoints of subgroup analysis by baseline ferritin levels supported the results of the main trial, and we're just about to do the big analysis by baseline ferritin, transferrin saturations, MCV, MCH, RDW.
Iron?
Yeah, well, actually, now you mention it, I've got to go back and make absolutely sure that we're doing serum iron levels and that. But the serum iron, you know, my understanding is that changes depending on whether or not you've had breakfast. So
yeah, it changes during the day. Yeah. As does transferrin saturation changes during the day.
True.
Which is why we were quite so startled looking at our data, what a profound effect serum iron had on outcome. And there's a really very striking relationship between increasing iron and better survival and lower iron and worse outcome.
So we've got that. We've also, in the future, we've got all the hepcidin, erythroferrone, and all the serum rhubarb. So, but you know, these results will be hypothesis generating and exploratory because they're not an a priori. So you've got to be careful in your interpretation thereof. But yeah, what is iron deficiency? Look, I mean, what can I say? Inflammation is cleverer than I am. I don't understand it. Do you?
No, absolutely not. Do I look like an immunologist? I mean, no. Every time I look at a textbook on the subject, it's changed radically from last time I've looked at a textbook on the subject. Hmm. I mean, the things we measure are just so crude. So, well, I mean, going back to the Hull database, we've published on CRP and outcome, and the higher your CRP, the worse the outlook is. But I mean, that's just such a crude measure of inflammation. I can't believe that's fundamentally related.
Yeah, and you're only doing it as a snapshot. You know, our results, we've got them at randomization and on day of surgery. Now, they're as good as they get because they're taken in controlled environments. The patient's blinded, everyone's blind. And they were central lab analyzed. So they're as good as you can get. But, you know, really, have we got everyone at the same time of day? Have they had the same breakfast? Mm. If they walk the same distance? I don't know the answer to all these questions. Yeah. So you've got to trust in methodology and randomization to look at a group effect. But that's all you can say. But the situation with heart failure, I'm going to come back to. So I've got a big white elephant on heart failure. Now, heart failure, my understanding as a surgeon, is you have a pump. It doesn't work as well. And so what happens is you can't shift the water around. Now, that water's also got some cells in it. But fundamentally, your blood is water and, you know, electrolytes and the rest of it.
Water with bits in,
Water with bits in. Now, when you measure a hemoglobin, you're measuring a concentration. But if you've got more water, your concentration will go down. So when you talk about anemia and heart failure, what is anemia and heart failure? Because isn't that a reflection of the state of your heart failure and the amount of plasma volume you've got going around?
Yeah, that's a very good question. When patients present, they present in one of two ways, either pulmonary edema, which actually in real life is quite rare unless it's on a surgical ward and you've lost given the patients far too much fluid, in which case, yes.
I've asked you a difficult question.
I know the answer. But actually, in the case of pulmonary edema, that is very interesting. When you give diuretics to patients who've got acute pulmonary edema and the fluid comes out of the alveolar space and into the blood, they do actually start becoming more dilute. The hemoglobin drops and they hemodilute just as the fluid comes out. And they're actually more hemoconcentrated than usual when they've got pulmonary edema. However, I think that's a sort of rare state of affairs. But yes, mostly patients turn up with 10, 20 litres of excess fluid on board. And yes, absolutely part of their anemia is that they have diluted out their red cells, that they have excess plasma volume. But one of the key things, of course, is we've now got pretty good modern diuretic therapy. And with modern diuretic therapy, that is not really a problem. It's always slightly difficult to be certain that when you've got somebody who's clinically euvolemic, they actually are euvolemic. But it would appear that they are.
One of the benefits of going back to the renal literature is in the renal patients, they're very good at weighing the patients.
Yes.
And patients have all got well-prescribed dry weights. Is that the same with your heart failure patients? And so can we trust the literature on non-anemic iron deficiency? Or is there a confounder here that some of these patients actually might be anemic? And the benefit might be seen in changing the hemoglobin mass in that population.
Yeah, yes. I mean, that is very difficult to guess at. We've got some data we've yet to publish on red cell mass using chromium radiolabeled red cells. It's a mixed bag, as you might imagine. There are some patients who have normal red cell mass, and there are some people who have low red cell mass, and there's one slightly odd bod who's got very high red cell mass. I've no idea what that's about. I suspect that may be experimental error, but it's really quite difficult to guess at the absolute truth of those measurements. And so we're left with these very crude, rather clunky things that you get out of standard blood tests. The other issue to me that always, just more broadly, I'm slightly anxious about potential toxicity from iron, and by that I mean partly that there is a temptation to say, right, the patient's iron deficient, let's give them some iron. And the toxicity arises because I've not investigated them for their underlying GI malignancy. And I think that's quite a problem in the heart failure population, because of course they're all 70s, 80s, and they're the population who are peak age for having underlying GI malignancy. And if we find that they're anemic and have little red cells, we should be investigating them on their merits. But I'm a bit anxious that that isn't happening. And what's actually happening is people are saying, oh, you're iron deficient, let's give you some intravenous iron, and not actually taking it further. I wonder what your thoughts of that are as a surgeon, really, because we should be investigating them, should we not?
Yeah, it was actually. And it was one of the first conversations and concerns I had with the design of the PREVENT study. Mm. And in their HF, they did actually do the investigation. And I think they followed those patients up. I think it's 2 years, and none of them turned out to have GI cancer. And that was quite a big relief. It was one of the barroom talks I had with Stefan about that to check on it. The other one was, what if I give iron to someone who's got occult hemochromatosis and I didn't realize it? And luckily, our professor of hematology, whose specialist interest was hemochromatosis, wrote a letter in support of the trial saying, well, we need to do it because otherwise society is just going to be giving iron to everyone. So we need to do this in the setting of a trial. And that was those two points were quite a saving grace for me. You've got to watch out for men becoming anemic. They just should not do that. I've got disclosures. I run an iron clinic, which is I'm about to turn into a charity. And we found a couple of colon cancers so far in 70-year-old men. Even if they've got heart failure, if they've got absolute iron deficiency, ferritin less than 30, then I send them off for a bidirectional endoscopy, no question. Younger men, they get the full works now, including capsule. Right. And we do, you can tell when you take your history that something's not right in the water. That's your diagnostic acumen, isn't it? I think the bigger thing that we're missing in society, and it's an area that I'm looking at, is the management of iron deficiency and anemia in women. And so we've done, in the last 10 years, we flipped an awful lot of our research into actually the thing that's staring us straight in the face, and that's the fact that one in eight women at any point in time have iron deficiency anemia. And we're kind of just taking it for granted, and it makes them feel rubbish. It's been fascinating, actually. We've done an awful lot of, we turn up to conferences. We went to nursing conferences. We've been to doctors' conferences. I've stood on street corners, railway stations, gyms, doing questionnaires about heavy menstrual bleeding and doing hemocue finger prick tests. And you know what? It's 12 to 14% of the female population. The vast majority have absolutely no idea that they're anemic. And I say anemic because there isn't a finger prick test that's decent for iron deficiency.
Yeah.
They don't know what heavy menstrual bleeding is. I think it's normal. It's quite astonishing, except for in Australia, where we did all the university students. So last week, actually, we did 450 university students. One in 12 female university students has had an iron infusion.
Wow.
But the incidence of anemia is less than 8%, markedly different.
Goodness me. So what's the explanation for why Australia has just taken iron to its bosom, so to speak?
We've got a private healthcare system. So the healthcare system here is driven on codes and rebates that are disseminated down to individual doctor level. So GPs get paid on the codes they charge. So if you diagnose iron deficiency and treat it with a PBS listed drug, you get paid for it.
So right.
Therefore, okay. They diagnose more of it. Yeah. That's been a bit brutal. The other side is, you do make a hell of a lot of people better. You really do. And that's where I come back to the quality of life thing. I think the Ironman study in heart failure is going to be fascinating, looking at mortality as a hard endpoint. But you know what? I'm not, you know, I'm 50, but I'm not 80. But I guess even at 50, I'm more interested, having been locked in Western Australia for 2 years, about the quality of my life, not the quantity of my life. And I think we need to really pay a lot of attention to quality of life for patients, particularly this elderly group of patients. So what truly matters to a heart failure patient? What is it? If you had a magic wand, what are the top three things a heart failure patient wants?
Is that a question you're hoping I can answer? It's such a moving field. One of the things that I had, my clinics on a Monday and a Friday morning, and I did a clinic yesterday. And
they want to get from Monday to Friday.
The most astonishing thing to me is that one of the people I saw was somebody I saw in about my second or third clinic when I started as a consultant here. So 20 years ago, God help us. And then the other three follow-up patients were people whose left ventricles had gone back to being entirely normal. And so the whole field of heart failure has changed so dramatically since I was a medical student, and I suspect since when you were a medical student, where it was more or less the kiss of death to be told that you had heart failure. It's become a condition almost, but not quite, that people live with rather than die from. And that comes back round to you thinking about quality of life. Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think quality of life becomes extremely important, however you try to measure it. But I do just have a memory of being at a conference fairly early on in the iron story, and the Cardiology Society had invited in a hematologist who didn't know anything about heart failure, and he was absolutely aghast that we were giving intravenous iron to these people, just because he thought that not because of the anaphylaxis or anaphylactoid reactions that you might get with the old-fashioned preparations of iron. He was just appalled that we were using this sort of blunderbuss treatment when we didn't really know what we were doing. We didn't know what body stores of iron were. He thought that iron was potentially toxic, particularly in terms of giving a high degree of oxidative stress, and that we might be doing harm. And that's why I think things like Ironman are so incredibly important, because yes, we can improve quality of life with all sorts of interventions in heart failure, but it's no good if it kills you. So in fact, the history of heart failure is littered with interventions that made people feel better. And I could reel off a few. So there was an ancient beta blocker that made you feel better but killed you more rapidly. There were orally active inotropic drugs that made you feel better but killed you more rapidly. So I think my feeling about iron is I have to be absolutely certain I'm not killing people by giving it. If Iron Man's neutral for mortality, that's terrific. I'll feel happy giving it. That won't bother me at all. But I just have at the back of my mind an anxiety that we might be missing something.
Less so, actually. I think there's a big difference between acute and chronic. And so if you were, and this is where I think the pivotal trial was really important. And the pivotal trial was randomizing people with renal failure to high dose, sort of high ferritin level. So I give them lots of iron compared to medium dose. And with the primary endpoint of harm in terms of mortality, and if, I think, I can't remember the primary, but it was harm of either killing people or infection. And it showed that that wasn't the case. I think with intravenous iron, the really interesting thing about it, and this is a kind of a bit of a gut feeling in predominantly my use, which actually is fatigued middle-aged women and heavy menstrual bleeding, is that you give, when you give the first dose, the first treatment to these people, it is revolutionary. These people are so happy. They really are. But what's interesting is they don't get, when you, they come back for repeat infusions, they don't get the same response. And so I think in, you know, and you hear the same about in renal failure, the first time you give intravenous iron to someone with renal failure, it's revolutionary. But then after that, it just comes a maintenance thing and they don't really notice a big difference. I don't have any reservations about giving anyone one dose of treatment level, you know, 1,000, 1,500 milligrams of intravenous iron. I'm fairly gung-ho about that. Multiple dosing, yeah, I get where you're coming from with multiple dosing because there's got to be something else going on. You know, 1,000 milligrams of iron, it's a big old dose. You know, that should keep you going for 3 to 5 years. And if you're having to keep giving it, unless you've got Crohn's or colitis, where you know, you're losing blood from your gut on a, you know, a quite horrific rate, then, you know, I'm not sure. I agree with you. I'm not sure what's going, there's something else going on.
Right. Okay. Well, I think we've been talking for over an hour now, Toby. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I think, well, we've got somebody who's clearly slightly more gung-ho about it and somebody slightly more sceptical. I just had the reservations of all those treatments for heart failure that came and went when we finally discovered we might be doing harm. So my view is that the jury is still slightly out as far as intravenous iron in heart failure is concerned. I absolutely take your point about thinking about absolute iron deficiency.
How did iron deficiency get into heart failure? I mean, you know, of all the cardiac conditions, why didn't they look at, you know, acute coronary syndrome, you know, the sort of more sexy end of cardiology or what the perception is?
Well,
what if intravenous iron stopped the need?
I just despair of the notion that all cardiology is blowing up balloons in things.
Bypasses work very well.
Yeah, well, no, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm trying to save people from the balloon wielding people. Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting question. I suppose it's because we've grown used to the idea that acute coronary syndromes are just that. They're acute, and we sort them out, we send them home, and that's the end of it. Whereas heart failure, of course, is... Sorry?
You don't follow them up very well.
No, absolutely.
It's just like surgery. You're brilliant at the front end.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can, someone even starts sneezing and they might have chest pain, they've got a coronary stent in.
Yes.
But then they get sent home on all these really quite malicious drugs. And 6 months later, they're trying to work out the names of the drugs and when they're supposed to be taking them. And their compliance is not brilliant. You know, we're not very good in medicine at chronic disease.
Well, I beg to differ. I think we're very good at chronic heart failure.
There's a bit in the middle that's missing.
Yes, okay. Well, speaking as a heart failure doctor, I'm taking the credit for looking after people with chronic heart failure very well. Okay, Toby, it's been an absolute joy talking with you. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. Information, informative, also entertaining and amusing. So thank you very much for your time and thank you for joining us from Australia. And we just await the results of Ironman and other trials running with mortality as an endpoint with the greatest possible interest in heart failure. Mm. Thank you very much. And thank you everybody for listening into the podcast. Bye-bye now.
Bye for now.
I think we stopped recording there. That was great.